topological insulator that I started with the SSH model. So that will be the first thing. Then I will go to friendly spin models, using which you can learn a lot. Then it turns out the basis of that is another quantum matter, namely Mott insulator. So I will spend about 10-15 minutes motivating about Mott insulator. What are Mott insulators? How they are different from band insulators? Very heuristically. Then I will start with a couple of models that Mott insulator can support. One is called the Majumdar-Ghosh model. Then my idea is to go to something called Kitaev model. Here also there is something called Shastri-Sutherland model. It's interesting, today, following the previous speaker of the class, I wanted to write in capital letters. Then I forgot about it in the second line. So that's the time scale. Okay. So topological insulator is a big field. Now a lot of activities are going on. Even what is fascinating is, even in the absence of electron-electron interaction and strong correlation effects, there is rich physics behind topological insulator. So, to the extent that Nobel Prize that was given to Taulas and company was related to ideas of topology in condensed matter. And after the work by Haldane and also Jean and Millet, it has become Jean Millet and others, it has become very, very important. So, there is a beautiful review article by R. Shankar. As you know, R. Shankar is a great worker and a teacher. So, in his characteristic style from Yale, who has a, it's in the archive. This is topological insulators. An introduction. It's a very beautiful article, review article. He discusses elementary ideas of Berry phase all the way up to deep ideas in topological insulator. It's all there in other textbooks also. So I will encourage you to look at Shankar's book. In fact, in what I will do with SSH model, Sushi-Ferrer's model, basically borrowed from Shankar's book. Please recall the model is the following. That is, you have electrons hopping on a lattice. Then Piles said that if you have one electron per atom, it will be a half-filled band, then there is an instability, the system will dimerize. And it can dimerize in two ways. So they correspond to two ground states. And then in nature, we have this material polyacetylene, where if you do a very simple quantum chemistry tight bending model, it should be a metal. But in practice, it gets dimerized and then you have the famous structure like this. So this is a dimerization pattern. So the bond length between carbon and carbon is shorter here then. So if you think about a tight bending model, the hopping matrix element is different. Now, If you look at this a chain with an open end and then go to the other dimerization pattern, it will look like this. So the first spin or the first electron doesn't know what to do because there is nobody to partner with, whereas others are paired up. Turns out this simple phenomena of having, suppose I had started with even number of spins, at the end, another end also will have an unpaired spin, unpaired electron. So it turns out there is a deep topology behind this particular phenomena. For example, if you look at this configuration, same number of atoms, everybody is paired up, it's supposed to be trivial topologically, whereas this is non-trivial topologically. So how it happens can be seen in a model which is discussed in great detail in Shankar's paper. That's the so-called SSH model, Su-Schrieffer-Higger model. And the idea is very simple. When you do a simple tight bending model, for example, here you have a hopping matrix element which is identical everywhere. Now, in this case, what you have is a new unit cell containing two atoms, and the hopping matrix element is definitely larger here between these two. So, characterized by two parameter, W and nu. That's the notation that Shankar uses. So the hopping matrix W. So you can, in this case, what has happened is W is larger than nu. Here, W is less than nu. When W is equal to nu, you have this uniform non-dimerized situation. So when you do a band structure calculation and then look at things in momentum space, you can clearly see a topology, non-trivial topology emerging in momentum space in this particular case and not in this case. And that is what is going to be a Berry phase analysis. Now you may wonder, what is the parameter that I am changing adiabatically? You can do a thought experiment in which you start from here and then continuously make W and nu change so that they become equal and then they change their relative magnitude like this. So you just change the lattice param expansion continuously, and that is what we will do. So also, I briefly indicated when you solve the problem, at the end of the day, I will not go into the details because I think I did it last time. Fairly straightforward, one electron problem of a problem hopping in this lattice with two hopping parameters. So inside the hopping cell, this W, between the cell, it's nu. Then you may remember, I just had this. So simply, it essentially says that this AK is a creation operator that I have constructed using sublattice A. BK is a creation operator I have gotten by using atom B from this sublattice. And there is a mixing between the two because of dimerization. In the absence of this dimerization, or when W is equal to nu, you get the simple cosine dispersion, well-known dispersion. Here you have a modification which is obtained by simply solving this, diagonalizing this 2 by 2 matrix. You may remember you get epsilon k simply diagonalizing this. This is the dispersion that you get. And then similarly, the eigenvectors will be slightly modified now. In addition to the plane wave factor, you have this amplitude. There is a phase which, depending on whether, because you remember that when you look at the band structure, originally you had a band structure like this. So this was a Brillouin zone minus pi by a to pi by a plus pi by a. After this Pyle's instability and gap opening, you have a new Brillouin zone which is pi by 2a and pi by 2a. So basically it's folded and there is a gap now. So you have a valence band and conduction band. So this is a filled band. So the wave functions have this plus and minus change when you look at the corresponding points above and below. That's all. It's simple. Now this phi of k depends on this off-diagonal elements, which is given by tan inverse of sin k divided by cos k. So this just follows from diagonalizing this 2 by 2 matrix and looking at the eigenvectors.
Sorry, quick question.
Yeah.
I didn't quite follow the calculation of the, like,
yeah,
this matrix, where does it come from? Because I'm used to
seeing it comes because, yeah, sorry, I should have, I thought I did it. So when you have no dimerization, this is the band structure. You obtain simply cosine ka. Now you have dimerization, that means there is an off-diagonal matrix element which connects a wave vector k and k pi by a. Because remember, I was telling in my last class, this dimerization is like a periodic potential with period 2a. So that connects a state with the corresponding state here whose wave vector is pi by a.
Yes.
So that is off-diagonal element.
Like if you have two states that are degenerate with each other and also at the edge of the Brillouin zone?
Yeah, exactly.
This
precisely.
But why are the diagonal elements zero? Because those would be the...
I choose my energy. See, that...
Oh, I see.
It's a diagonal energy.
Okay.
So that's a so-called hopping matrix element. Yeah.
And the periodic potential is simply the atoms.
So you bring the atoms together. So like this, according to Pyle's, this is an unstable situation, a stable situation in which atoms have come together, so that self-consistently they have produced a periodic potential, and that creates scattering and opens a gap in the electronic spectrum, which gains energy, and that you remember goes as distortion times log of distortion, and then there is a you lose energy from the lattice strain, you optimize it, you get this. Maybe I rushed it through last time.
But okay, the cosine was just for the free and then...
Exactly, nearest neighbor hopping gives you cosine. And then now because you have a hopping amplitude which is larger within the cell, that gives you this off-diagonal term. Because you remember, sorry, I should have said that this AK corresponds to Fourier transform of A type of atoms. B corresponds to Fourier transform of B type of atoms. When you have no dimerization, everybody comes back together. Then you have this band. Okay?
Okay.
Now is the Berry phase analysis. So it's very clear that you can look at extreme cases in which nu is 0, then you will have flat bands like this. When nu equal to 0, there is no hopping, so electron hops back and forth, it forms a bonding and antibonding state. So they are these two. But however, similarly, when nu equals 0, there is a bonding and antibonding state. But however, there are two states lying exactly at the middle, so-called zero energy state. Because this state has nobody to hop to, so its energy remains as 0. Similarly, the other end of the chain, it remains 0. So they are called zero energy state or mid-gap states. Well, all the others have undergone bonding and antibonding splitting. Now we can ask the question, how this situation varies when you adiabatically turn on nu. Then you can imagine these flat bands becoming curved like this. That is what happens. So there is dispersion now, there is hopping. So what was flat, now because they get hybridized between cells also, becomes curved and you have this. However, so that happens here also. But this end state, which was here, it cannot disappear. What it will do is it will leak into the inside the chain, but then it will exponentially decay. This is something that you can show. So the zero mode survive even when you make this nu finite. So they are topologically protected. Now, what is the topology behind it and what is the Berry phase? That is what I will do next. And these are all important because the so-called topological insulate, which became very famous, Kane and Millet and Haldane and so on, what you find is a fascinating situation in which a bulk is an insulator, but the surface is forced to be a metal, because this is very counterintuitive. Normally, if you take an insulator like diamond, everybody will be happy, and then like sodium chloride, extreme example. If the bulk is an insulator, the surface also will be an insulator. But in band theory, depending on the topology that you have and depending on the spin orbit coupling, you are forced to have an insulating bulk and a conducting surface. So that comes precisely from topology, and also topology tells you the nature of the surface. Here, since lack of time, I am just focusing on a simple model. Here, what you do is the topology forces you to have a free surface state or edge state, because it has zero energy, so it has a free spin. And you can add one more electron and make it charged, or remove an electron and make it again charged without spin. That's what I was telling yesterday. Okay. Now what do? In fact, this is related to a famous Thoulas, Komoto, Nightingale, his formula. Because you may ask the question in the context of Berry phase, I change some parameter and then calculated Berry curvature and so on. Here, what is the parameter I choose? Here, it turns out what happens is, if you look at momentum space and then look at the eigenfunctions are just one particle states are just two-dimensional Hilbert space. So, what you can imagine in the sense, I can have a state in which I have an electron or no electron. So, it is just a fermionic oscillator. Then I can imagine how this wave function change when I move in momentum space. So, that is like change in parameter in Berry phase analysis. You remember in Berry phase analysis, what did we do? We changed some parameter and found out how the eigenfunctions occur extra phase. So, in the same way, we will look at the change in this wave function as k is changed as a parameter in the Brillouin zone. Now, my range of my parameter is a Brillouin zone, which goes from minus pi by a to plus pi by a. Okay. Now, I will again just indicate, it is straightforward. In fact, Shankar does it in detail. So, I will put the blame on Shankar. What you find is, this is a 2 by 2 matrix which characterizes the coupling between the k levels and the k plus q, right. Now, this 2 by 2 matrix can be written as sigma dot h, where sigma is a Pauli matrix. And in particular, you can choose this h to have x and y component corresponding to the real and imaginary part. Then what you will find is, in this hx, HOA plane. When you are in this trivial phase, corresponding to everybody paired up, no zero edge state, when you change this parameter k, what you find is that the Berry phase that you calculate, namely this related to phi, creates, it moves around the circle which does not occupy the origin. So then when you do this, you get 0, that is, this you do not subtend any angle. Whereas when you do the other limit, what you find is it encircles the origin. So that means I have acquired a pi phase 2 pi when I go around. It is as simple as that. When you do the algebra, you will get that. So that means in terms of Berry phase, there is a non-trivial Berry connection in this case and trivial connection there. And that is the, so it is a trivial example of Berry phase.
Sorry, what is TKNN?
Sorry? TKNN. Okay, yeah. So, sorry. So, before Berry, Thouless, Komoto and Nightingale and Dennis, they wrote a beautiful formula for quantum Hall effect. So, what they studied was, they studied the electron in strong magnetic field in the presence of periodic potential. They converted the conductivity formula into a formula in momentum space. They rewrote the conductivity formula, and that involved Berry curvature of the wave function in momentum space. So that's where, that's a very famous formula, and this is a very simple illustration of that idea in one dimension. So you will find detailed discussion about TKNN formula in Shankar's paper and many other places are there. That's what I mentioned. So the idea is the following. So here it's a very clear that there are two unpaired electrons, so they have to form a state which is rallying in the middle of the band. So they are the zero modes, and there is a topological justification of their existence in terms of Berry phase, which I just sketched. Now, when you do it for topological insulators in two dimension, then you find corresponding to this edge state, you have something called edge current state. That's something very, very important. So, I said that in the polyacetylene case, I have two unpaired electrons, so they create zero modes. So, suppose I have a two dimensional system like this. It was shown by Haldane, a beautiful analysis of taking a graphene like situation, which is like hopping in two dimension on a honeycomb lattice. He showed under some conditions, you will have a bulk which is gap. Then there will be excitations which carry current, which have zero energy excitations moving around the bulk in one direction. These are called chiral edge modes. This also follows from beautiful topology that was discussed by, called Haldane's model. A close model is Kane-Millay model.
Sorry, what is Kane-Millay?
I will explain Kane, yeah, model. So what did I do in the case of one dimension? I simply changed, created a dimerization. Then I found there are two examples in which there is no edge mode, there is an edge mode. Now, it is non-trivial in two dimensions, so you have to do a little more than that. What Haldane did was, he studied problem of hopping of electrons on a honeycomb lattice, which is the problem of graphene. Then anticipating some new physics, he added some parameters in the Hamiltonian, hopping parameter, which may look very unphysical to begin with, but it has profound consequences. Then it can be justified physically by Kane. So what Haldane did was that an electron has a very strongly hopping amplitude between two neighboring sites in the graphene model. But then he said it can also hop to next nearest neighbor. Let me call it as a T prime. So, for example, okay. Then in order to bring in this physics of topology, what Haldane does is, he imagines a change in phase of the hopping matrix element. You make the hopping matrix element complex, so that when you go around, that it's like a Bohm-Mahorno phase factor. This is something I do not know if you are familiar with. You are familiar with Bohm-Mahorno phase factor in continuum theory. But you, so where you have P minus EA. So, for example, then the wave. This is how it Bohm-Mahorno phase factor appears if you do interference experiment. The external vector potential appears like this. When you do the same thing on a tight binding model, suppose I have a situation like this. I have three orbitals, an electron can hop. Now apply a magnetic field for flux phi. Okay. Then it turns out Piles discovered it long back. The tight binding model has no P momentum in like continuous momentum. So it has a hopping matrix element. So what Piles said was that this hopping matrix element T will be substituted by some phase factor. Let me call it as 1, 2, 3, 1 and 2. This will be e to the power of phi 2 and 3. This will be e to the power of phi 3 and 1. Or I could have thought about this T as e to the power of I e by c 1 and 2. That is, I have a hopping, but this hopping is different from a differential motion described in the continuum theory. So Piles said that I can capture this in a tight bending model by substituting this link variable, or you can call it as a, like a Wilson line, connecting site I and j through a dot dl in this way, so that when you go full round, you will get a closed loop that will capture the flux. So this is called a Piles substitution. It's amazing that Piles discovered it many, many years ago.
I thought Piles substitution refers to the continuous case.
Sorry?
I thought Piles substitution refers to the continuous case.
Yeah. How do you generalize? Because you know how to introduce vector potential in a continuum theory. That's a P is substituted by P E minus. Suppose I have a problem in which tight binding model, I have just orbitals. Then how do I bring in external magnetic field? Piles suggested there is a prescription, which is this. It's called. So what you do is you take the hopping matrix element and add a phase to that hopping matrix element, which corresponds to this line integration. Now, if you go one full round, you will get precisely what you get in the continuum theory. So it's a generalization of P minus EA by C to tight bending model, which is called a Piles substitution. Okay. So, what Haldane did was, he introduced some Piles substitution, imagining some flux going through every triangle with opposite sign. I will not go into the details. The net flux is zero. But however, because the time reversal symmetry is broken, what you find is you have something called an edge mode, which carries current. So, even though you have a bulk, which is an insulator, the edge carries current. This was Haldane's discovery, and Haldane motivated this. He called it as quantum Hall effect without any external magnetic field, because you can argue that this will quantization condition will be satisfied and so on. Then came Kane and Mele. They said that, in fact, this is true even without external magnetic field if you consider spin orbit coupling. You remember, what is spin orbit coupling? It's a relativistic effect. An electron feels the angular momentum of the other electron through the spin. So, when you come to tight bending models, when you come to solid state situation, spin orbit coupling appears the same way Piles phase factor appeared, by a process in which when an electron hops from here to here, it can spin, can flip, because there is an orbital motion. So in general, the spin can flip. So this is a spin orbit coupling term. So what Ken Mayle did was, they put spin orbit coupling in the nearest neighbor, next nearest neighbor hopping term. They got mathematics which is exactly like Haldane's. And what a miracle is, in at the end of the day, you have two spin species. So they will each create their own charge current, but the charge current will move in the opposite direction. So the end result will be a spin current which will be moving in this direction. I'm sorry, I have no time to explain these things. It's a beautiful phenomena in which you will find in this topological insulator defined by Ken Mayle, you will have a spin current excitation, no charge excitation. So there is a corresponding Hall effect called spin Hall effect. Like the standard Hall effect is a charge Hall effect. So that was a prediction and it was experimentally seen. Okay, sorry, you know, because I didn't want to go beyond SSH model, but I thought I'll just indicate to you why SSH model captures the essence of whatever. So it's discussed in great detail in Shankar's paper. So with that, I will close this. Yeah.
Maybe if again you could just comment on the link with experiment. Are these just?
No, no, very important. Exactly. Link with the experiment. So it turns out, as soon as this was proposed, Moller Kamp and company in Germany, Wurzburg. So they created materials where they're called topological insulators with spin orbit coupling, where they observed spin Hall effect. So it's experiment, it was a prediction, and it was seen. Now it's a very active field. Lot of spin Hall effect in, because it turns out when you look at quantum matter involving heavy atoms, spin orbit coupling is non-trivial. Normally we ignore it. When you look at diamond or graphite, we ignore spin orbit coupling because they are light atoms. But if you come to bismuth, in fact, there is a famous material called bismuth. So bismuth is very heavy, selenium is also heavy. So they, in combination, they have very strong spin orbit coupling. So this material exhibits topological insulator property. Since the bulk is an insulator, but the surface supports beautiful conducting states and lots of physics, spin Hall effect and so on. So it's a rich experimental field also, even without electron-electron interaction. Then some of you may like to go further on that in detail. In fact, there is a chapter in Quantum Theory of Solid by Kittel, I have given you the reference, about electronic structure and band structure effect. There he apparently discusses everything that is necessary to discover Ken Mayle model, except that he has not written the name Ken Mayle model. Topology, everything is there. This is what I heard from my friend Nagawasa. But anyway, so this has been in the air, and then and Ken Mayle put it beautifully in a very simple model, and then indicated experimental relevance, and then it has become a very important field now. Okay, now I will go into my other what I wanted to do, namely friendly models. So to understand the friendly models, we need to understand what a Martin insulator is. In fact, Martin insulator is very simply the way, if you follow Mott's arguments, you can understand Martin insulator very easily. We all know what a band insulator is. For example, if you take diamond, it's a band insulator. You have filled bands and empty bands. There is a large gap, and the gap comes from because of periodic potential. And if you think in terms of quantum chemistry, there is an sp3 bonding, and every pair is bonded, and so on. We will not go into the detail, but simple Kronig Penny model of electron moving in a periodic potential gives you bands and band gaps. So you fill up some band, then it becomes a band insulator. Another simple example of a band insulator is helium-4 solid, because you have two electrons tied to the parent atom, and they when you bring them together and apply pressure, they do overlap, but still they are all below the conduction band, so they are filled valence band. Now, Mott thought of the following experiment. Imagine you have, let me take a, for simplicity, a square lattice of hydrogen atom. Let me say I just take monovalent hydrogen atom and form a square lattice. Please don't ask me how you will do it. You may ask cold atom friends or ion trap friends, they will do it for us. In fact, they are doing it these days. So, when the distance between two neighboring hydrogen atom is comparable to the size of the hydrogen atom or Bohr radius, you can imagine it will form a band, because an electron would like to hop. That means it will see a periodic potential. So, and you can just focus on 1s orbital of electron alone, because in principle an electron can be excited because there is a perturbation to 2s, 2p and so on, but they are higher energy. So, you focus on the relevant low energy orbital, that is a 1s orbital. That is the spirit of what is called tight bending model. So, I will build a model which is exact like the model I had for SSH thing, except that the local orbital is 1s orbital and then there is a hopping matrix element T. So, when I do this problem, what you find is for this problem, I have a two-dimensional Brillouin zone. K space is like this. Then I have a dispersion like this. Then I have one electron per site. And then every plane wave state can contain two electrons. What you will find is, you will find it becomes a half-filled band, which is a metal. You can do it for one dimension also. If you take a collection of one-dimensional hydrogen atom, the band structure is cosine exactly like what we had before. Then I will have a half-filled band. There is one electron per site given by hydrogen atom, but then every momentum state takes two electrons, you have a half-filled metal. Okay, good. Now, this is obvious, it should be a metal in spite of Coulomb repulsions and so on. Then Mott argued, suppose I adiabatically expand the lattice, make the distance between neighboring hydrogen atom larger and larger by changing the lattice parameter of the square lattice. He envisaged a situation in which electron will be reluctant to leave its home site, because an electron is bound to the nucleus proton with a binding energy of 13 electron volt. So, now you would like to hop here. Now, when the distances are large, the hopping becomes like a tunneling. So, you do not gain much in delocalization. And in particular, when you leave home, you will have to lose 13 electron volt. So, what Mott said was a very simple physical statement. A situation will come in which, when the lattice parameter is larger than few times Bohr radius, it will become an insulator. And there is no periodic potential which is creating a band gap now. I have just a collection of atoms. For convenience, I choose them in a periodic pattern. And then they formed a band to begin with. And then I had a half-filled band, I had a metal. Now I expand the lattice. Then I argue that Coulomb cost prevents me from delocalizing and tells me that I should stay home. So this is a Mott insulator, as simple as that. In reality, how it happened was, when people are looking at oxides, in oxides you have a transition metal which can have electron in the d orbital, and then in between oxygen comes. Oxygen is like an insulating, it gets filled. So basically you are expanding in oxides the transition metal subsystem, creating, then suddenly they found insulating behavior where band theory told you it should be a metal. In fact, these days there are many, many examples in hydrides. What you do is you take hydrogen atom and put them in some metal, and then they basically ionize the hydrogen atom and then hydrogen molecule, and then they keep them separate and it becomes like an insulator.
So does the insertion of the oxygen literally expand the
basically that. And the crudest approximation, because oxygen acquires two electrons from the transition metal atoms. Since you asked this question, let me give this famous example of CuO. It's a famous Mott insulator. So, you know, oxygen has two less electrons in the 2p shell. So, it like happily grab two electrons and then form a closed shell. So, it's for practical purposes, it's inert. Then what is copper? Copper, you may remember, has a configuration 3D8, 3D9. This is a configuration of copper. So there are 9 electrons in the D shell and 1 electron in the 4s shell. Sorry, 3D10. Excuse me. So it has a filled D shell and 1 electron in the S shell. Now, since oxygen grabs 2 electrons, you are left with Cu2 plus, which is 3D9. You remember in D shell there can be 10 electrons if you want to fill it. So you have one less electron, it's like having a hole. So in copper oxide, what happens? Oxygen comes in between and then dilates the copper sublattice and then creates a situation like what Martin envisaged. So according to band theory, if you do a theory for this, it will be a metal. But in reality, you don't see a metal, you see an insulator. Because the D hole in copper, which is analogous to one electron in the S shell, it's not energetically favorable for it to delocalize and band gain band delocalization energy. See, in quantum mechanics, it's very important that one particle states try to get extended in order to gain kinetic energy because it wants to have least momentum. So when I'm forcing an electron to be in its some home site, I'm giving a large momentum fluctuation. So large energy is there. There is an energy cost. But however, if I am going to lose that energy by repulsion from neighboring electrons, I would rather stay home. That's what is happening here. So this is called a Mott insulator. Now the next the important thing is, okay, I have a Mott insulator, then what about the spin? So I have expanded it sufficiently wide, large, then I have a spin degree of freedom. So this is a fundamental difference between a band insulator like diamond and Mott insulator. Because in a Mott insulator, I have a spin degree of freedom which doesn't know what to do. Whereas in a diamond, every degree of freedom is frozen. So there is a gap for spin and charge excitation. So Mott argued, and later people like Anderson and others, so what will the spin degree of freedom do? So ideally, if I take an approximation, there is a 2 to the power of n fold degeneracy of spin configuration, because every spin here can be in 2 up or down state. So if there are n atoms in the problem, there is huge degeneracy, 2 to the power of n fold degeneracy. Whereas a band insulator like diamond is just one ground state, unique ground state. So here there is an enormous spin degeneracy. Now we argue that quantum fluctuations will come and break the degeneracy. That's where magnetism comes. So this is done beautifully in a simple model that was done by many people, including Anderson, many, many years ago. I will do that. Suppose I have 2 hydrogen atoms which are well separated. Then according to Mott, the electron will stay home. They will not tunnel in the zeroth approximation. So the ground state is 2 to the power of 2 fold degenerate in terms of spin degree of freedom. But however, this is not going to be the end of the day, end of the problem, because there will be quantum fluctuation. Because it turns out 2 neighboring spins, even though they are away there, because of wave function overlap, there could be quantum fluctuations in which there is a virtual transition of this state to this state. So when I do that, what do? I am going to an excited state, maybe for a short time. So if I do perturbation theory, what you do is this process, and then I can come back. This is something very important, beginning of magnetism. So let me start with 2 spins which are up and down. Then symmetry allows me that I can make a virtual jump and then come back to an exchange configuration. When you do perturbation theory for this process, you will find I gain an energy which is this, where T is the hopping matrix element, which is very small. Then U is the energy that I am in when I am in this excited state. This excited state, that is, I plug this electron from its parent home site and put it here. So in the process, I spent a large energy U minus 4T square over U. Then I come back. Then I ask the question, is it possible for this to happen if the spins were parallel? The answer is no, because Mr. Pauli will prevent it. So Pauli principle prevents quantum spin fluctuations if the two neighboring spins are in a spin triplet state. So Pauli principle allows quantum fluctuations in the singlet state. So Coulomb repulsion and Pauli principle join together and start selecting the spin state. That's the beginning of magnetism. So all this is now summarized in the so-called Heisenberg Hamiltonian, which is this. You notice that I am dealing with the electrons. Electron has spin and charge. But the way I have discussed the physics, the way I have created a situation, charge degree of freedom is essentially frozen, but it undergoes some virtual fluctuations. But then it starts connecting spins, so it produces an effective coupling between the spin degree of freedom, which is the so-called Heisenberg coupling. So you notice Coulomb repulsion and Pauli principle together generates an effective coupling between spin degree of freedom in a Mott insulator. So that's a beautiful thing. So Mott insulator, the spins, we are not forgotten the spins. Spins are there because they are the soft degree of freedom, and they communicate among themselves through this beautiful coupling, which we all talk about, Heisenberg coupling between two spins.
But were you saying that this was the origin of the Heisenberg model, or?
Sorry?
Was this the origin of the Heisenberg model, or?
Okay, sorry. Yeah, there is a subtlety. When Heisenberg talked about, he did not talk about this. This is called kinetic exchange. So he talked about direct exchange. When the wave functions overlap, there is a quantum mechanical exchange between parallel spin, which makes it ferromagnetic coupling. So Heisenberg's original coupling is ferromagnetic, whereas this coupling is antiferromagnetic. But the form of interaction, the analytic form, is identical. In fact, there is a detailed article by Phil Anderson about direct versus indirect exchange in insulators. So when Heisenberg wrote it down, he wrote it down not for this process that I'm talking about. But they are all the same called Heisenberg Hamiltonian, and the coupling in the present case is positive. Now, because you can easily, because when you have two spins which are antiferromagnetically coupled, you can convince yourself is the ground state. So what is happening is, because of this effective coupling, the two spins dance around, up, down, minus, down, because it's a singlet state.
That I just missed.
Yeah.
I know you explained it, but weren't we saying that the atoms are too far apart for tunneling to happen?
No, I'm keeping them apart.
Yeah.
So when I bring them together in a metallic state, atom will be happily to leave home because they run around and gain energy and form block states, and band theory works. When I expand the lattice, the bandwidth becomes smaller. Bandwidth is a measure of energy I gain. Because, see, the hopping matrix element, at the end of the day, if you find out, it's a tunneling matrix element. What is a hopping matrix element? I have a proton here, another proton here. There is an electron here, another electron here. So how do you form band? This electron quantum mechanically tunnels over this barrier. That is a hopping matrix element that we normally put by hand. Now, when you separate them farther, this tunneling matrix element becomes exponentially small. So the bandwidth becomes narrow, and then there is no more advantages to pluck my electron from home and make it into a block state. Block states can be constructed, but they are high energy states.
And I'm just asking because this process does involve the tunneling, right?
But virtual tunneling, not real tunneling. It's not a it's very important. This is a good question. So when I'm doing this, it's like zero-point vibration. Suppose I have a harmonic oscillator potential. The classical potential will tell me the particle will be at the minimum. Now, when I introduce p square by 2m term, what happens? It starts quantum fluctuating. So, in the same way, this is the minimum energy if there were no quantum fluctuations. Once you introduce quantum fluctuation, they start fluctuating. And that comes through this kind of virtual processes. So, now you can control them, the amount of exchange, by separating them. For example, people in cold atom, they try to do this. In fact, they try to create Mott insulators in optical lattices by expanding the lattice, and whereas in experiments it's really difficult to do, but in cold atoms and optical Rydberg atoms, they try to do this. Okay. So, I have given you some idea about why magnetic Hamiltonians are there in the case of Mott insulator. It tells you that typically in a Mott insulator, there will be antiferromagnetic coupling between spins. So, now when I look at a full Hamiltonian of a square lattice, now it turns out this Hamiltonian, even though you have written it beautifully, and by the way, the form S dot S tells you there is a rotation invariance in spin space, because I have chosen some basis up and down, but I could have chosen any basis. So, it expresses the fact that there is rotation invariance. That is how Heisenberg also argued, that there is a rotation invariance in the absence of spin orbit coupling. So, it has to have that form. Okay. Now, we have derived the Hamiltonian like many problems, but we do not know how to solve it. Two sides we can solve it. Suppose I have a collection of spins forming a square lattice, and this is called Heisenberg model. When J is negative, it is called a ferromagnetic Heisenberg model. The ground state is trivial, in which everybody is pointing in the same direction. Whereas J is positive, we do not know the ground state. In fact, there are good approximations to say that the ground state is an antiferromagnet with quantum fluctuations. Now, this is has been one of the big problems in the field of high temperature superconductivity, according to the theory of resonating valence bond initiated by Phil Anderson. This exchange coupling is at the heart of superconductivity. So, we need to understand what is the nature of ground state of this problem and spectrum. Now, it turns out there is a lot of things that you have to learn from a one-dimensional model that I have written down. What I have written is for a square lattice. Imagine I make it simpler. I told you about two sides. Suppose I have a collection of spins forming one-dimensional lattice. Is it solvable? The answer is yes, but with great, it's not a friendly solution, in my opinion. That was done by Hans Bethe many, many years ago. Bethe unsorts. But you may remember when Emily did the Jordan-Wigner transformation for you in the first class, in the tutorial, she solved part of this model, because what you have is the three components of the Heisenberg spin. Now, if you take the two components alone, then it becomes what is called X-ray model, and through Jordan-Wigner transformation that can be solved. Similarly, when you take two dimension, you can solve it through a trick called spin wave theory, Hallstein-Primakov transformation. I have no time to go into it. So, there are many, many methods which are available in solid state theory, which you will see in Kittel's book and others, where you can study this quantum problem. But when quantum fluctuations becomes very large, it takes you into different corners of the Hilbert space, and many, many simple intuitions fail. This is where the model called Majumdar-Ghosh model, which was done in 1970s, early, it's a very useful model to think about things. And also it tells you a philosophy. Hilbert space is very big, too big to comprehend. So, when you have an antiferromagnetic order in three dimension, you go to the right corner of the Hilbert space or the vicinity of the ground state through physical intuition of long range order and so on. But when quantum fluctuations are large, you don't know which corner of Hilbert space that you are going to. So, what did Majumdar and Ghosh do? For some very good reason, I know like Majumdar was like my teacher. Fortunately, he is no more. Deepan Ghosh is my friend. So they wrote this paper. And also, I tell students, please try to invent your own model, exactly solvable model. However trivial it may look like, it will have some nature is always kind and finds a place for your model. So please keep it in your mind to discover your own model. It's not a, and I was telling that discover your own model, write down your own model. However trivial it may look like, nature is always kind and find a application. That is how, you know, because I am talking about difficulty in solving in general Heisenberg spin systems exactly. Emily solved it for chain problem if you have XY anisotropy, Jordan-Wigner transformation. But if you have Heisenberg coupling, you cannot solve it. Bethe solved it using Bethe ansatz, which is, in my opinion, very unfriendly. It doesn't, you know, it's not very physical.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. It's a little.
Whereas we will discuss a couple of models which are very friendly because I can do it. Okay. So that's the model of Majumdar and Ghosh. What they did was, they took a chain and then add nearest neighbor exchange coupling. And in addition, they added a next nearest neighbor exchange coupling, which is exactly half of it. So it has a nearest neighbor repulsion antiferromagnetic coupling and next nearest neighbor antiferromagnetic coupling. Then they found a very nice thing. In fact, I will not go into the history of that. So what have I done? I have just rewritten this Hamiltonian in this language. So I have S1. So I take a spin, pick up its two neighbors, I plus 1 and I plus 2, sum the three spin and square it. Now if you expand it, you will find you get this basically. Because what you will get is, you will get Si dot Si plus 1, which is this term. Then you will get Si dot Si plus 2 twice, because when you make the combination of three spins, can form these spin and so on. So they overlap. So you will get this term half the time, you will get this term twice or once. Then they observed, okay, now I want to minimize this Hamiltonian, I want to construct the ground state. You notice term by term it's positively definite because it's a square of an operator. Now this is sum of three spin half object, you know the sum of three spin half, the minimum spin is half. Maximum spin is 3/2. So they closed their eyes and wrote down a configuration like this. They said two spins form a singlet. These two spins form a singlet and so on. So they say this is a ground state. How do you show that? Now look at these three. So these two spins form a singlet, the spin is 0. So this fellow is dancing with somebody else. So as far as this state is concerned, the spin is half, but it's quantum fluctuating, but the total spin is half for this cluster. Similarly, for this cluster, the total spin is half. So in one shot, they wrote down the exact wave function. And they became famous, you know, it became very famous. Because it turned out, this model is friendly to the extent you find the right corner in the Hilbert space where is your ground state. You don't know about the excited state spectrum, whereas Bethe gave all the spectrum of excited states in full glory. However, we can guess the nature of excited states. And that's what Shastri did when he was a PhD student. Incidentally, Sriram Shastri is a very distinguished condensed matter theorist who is at Santa Cruz. He was a student of Majumdar, Chanchal Majumdar at Tata Institute. So now, how will I create an excitation? Can somebody guess how will I create an excitation here? Because we have learned about polyacetylene. Okay, I will. Exactly. Very good. That's it. So, locally this is a ground state. This is not a ground state because you notice I have these three spins. So it's fluctuating. It can be 3/2, half and so on. So it's not an exact excitation, but it's like 80%, there are small quantum corrections. So what you find is a beautiful excitation which is locally a spin half. Or I can also imagine an excitation which I break a domain wall and create a singlet and then create a spin one state. Then it turns out the spin ones drift apart, remaining a spin half. So this is like a two domain walls together. So all these beautiful things happen with this Majumdar-Ghosh model. So
could you write that name down once?
Sorry?
Could you write that name down once?
Majumdar-Ghosh? Okay, sorry. Majumdar-Ghosh. Model.
Thank
you. Yeah. In fact, this is a forerunner of a model called Affleck, Kennedy, Lieb and Tasaki model, very popular model. In fact, it started the field of SPT symmetries and so on. I will indicate it in the next class. But this is the friendly model where you can write down the exact wave function, ground state wave function. You can also intuitively say what are the excited states, domain wall excitation. These are all called the topological excitation because, as I should have mentioned it, when you look at this, you could have paired these spins like in polyacetylene in different ways also. So Majumdar-Ghosh model, if you have a cyclic boundary condition, has two degenerate ground state. So the soliton excitations are excitations that have one type of ground state on the left and another ground state on the right, and so on. So at the moment, these are all sitting there. But when you do dynamics of this problem, you'll find they start moving and form block states. So they are non-trivial block states of topological excitations, and so many things are happening. Okay, I will close it here. So I'm glad that at least I touched this Majumdar-friendly model. So next class I will do some other model, Shastri's Sutherland model, and then Kitaev model, and then end up with Sachdev A. Kitaev model in the next two classes. So now the model is mathematically beautiful model. You can hold on to it and get a lot of information and go to different parts of Hilbert space. Thank you.